Good afternoon, everyone. The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Welcome, committee. We're going to start off with some committee business and some activities and get an update from Dr. Warner, the Legislative Revenue Officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, members of the committee. Of course, as usual, the revenue committees are ahead of the other committees. You've already organized and adopted your rules.
That's right.
In August. So I thought what we could do to kind of start off, since this is our first official interim meeting, is to go over some of the bigger issues that we kind of, that were things that you talked about at the end of last session, some things that we kind of left with some decisions to be made in the future. And so I've made put a list of that together for you. If you look under committee issues, and emailed that to you all last Friday, I think, or Thursday. So just to go through those with you, and we'll spend some time on a couple of these today, or part of the agenda. The first is to continue the work that you started, many of you started years ago, but this committee really started working on last regular session, was the tax reform options. And the House Bill 2171 does give us the direction to conduct an analysis of major proposals. So we've started to do that, and that's one of our agenda items. We have been working to update the OTIM model, and we have some preliminary results for you to kind of start your thinking process. And then with the idea being that we'll fine-tune those and work to some more specifics and have something ready for the 16th session that you can, more detailed language to discuss. The second item was an issue that you spent a lot of time on last session, and you know, there was a lot of questions and concerns about where we're going in terms of the tax haven law. As you recall, Senate Bill 61 did make some policy changes, made some changes to make it clear that when you have income reported in a listed a tax haven, that you can on your tax return indicate that income that's reported in that tax haven did not originate in the U.S. And that's a significant policy clarification, I think, compared to the initial law in 2013. You'll also charged us with when data becomes available to analyze what we're getting coming in on the tax returns. Corporations are going to be filing and say yes. They're going to check a box, yes, I do have income in a listed jurisdiction, and we can start to get some feel for how that shows up in terms of the actual data. I'm not anticipating anything real specific until you get kind of in the second leg of the interim after the 16 session. There's about a year and a half lag on corporate data. An issue that Kyle will talk with you some about today is the nonprofit property tax laws. There's a lot of different aspects on this. You spent some good deal of time around the museums. Remember, you did enact a temporary law that was sunsets in 4 years. But as we've talked to assessors, and I know they've talked to you, it's real clear that the current law is being implemented differently in different counties around the state. And so the idea here would be to try to get a better understanding of exactly what's out there. Kyle's been working with the assessors and Department of Revenue, and he'll update you on what he's done and what he's proposing to do. And we're hoping to have both revenue chairs designate a couple of members to kind of give us direction as we go through and try to develop something for the 17th.
This is the same chair that killed the bill on the other side, right? I'm just checking.
Yes, this is actually on the committee issues on the other
committee. Well, you got to the agenda over there. I'm just checking here, Mr. Chair.
It's on their committee issues too, yes.
We were going to do this, remember, and then they decided that we shouldn't do it. So I was just checking.
So, but that's, you know, there's a lot of work involved in that because there's a lot of different aspects of that statute. So, and some of them, you know, they've gotten most attention have been around healthcare and hospitals because that's where there's potentially a lot of property there. But also there's a whole series of different institutions that are potentially affected by the law. the next kind of overview issue I have is a tax credit review. And of course, we're by statute required to provide a report to you at the beginning of each long session. And the next round is we've gone full cycle. We broke up the credits into three groups, and we've had the 11, 13, and 15 sessions to go through those groups, and now we're back to the 11 group, even though some change, for example, the film credit was part of the 11 group. You extended that early. So things like that change the groupings, but this still has the main ones. And the big one is, big ones, are the energy-related credits, kind of the cousins and offspring of Betsy. So those are those sunsets are coming due, and there's some issues there for you to discuss, and there's other economic development related ones like the research and development credit, for example. The other major policy I have listed here is the state reserve fund policy. Again, something this committee spent a lot of time on last session, you have a task force that. Became law at the end of 15 session was the Senate Bill 800. Both the two revenue chairs and vice chairs are on that task force, and along with Ways and Means members. So we're envisioning kind of working, reporting back to this committee on a regular basis on the things that are going on in that task force around reserve funds. We are seeing conditions now where, the overall current numbers still look very good, especially around the employment numbers we've seen for the state and for the country as a whole. But we're also seeing some real weakness develop at a worldwide level. And we're continuing to see days like today where the stock, where the S&P was down 50 points and the Dow was down 300 points. So there's growing concern out there about, I don't know if it's so much about an actual recession as what we used to call a growth recession, where we move into a period of a lot slower growth. And when you get some financial instability, that can have significant impacts on our revenue stream. The last item.
I have a question on that.
Senator Bocas.
Thank you. Paul, if correct me if I'm wrong, I think we will see a revenue report just before the 17th session. And the reason I specifically asked that is, the Fed Reserve is meeting again in January and or December, and the anticipation of a rate increase at the end of the year, which is the most likely trigger of a slowdown. Mm-hmm. So do we get a revenue forecast in January?
You get a revenue forecast right at the beginning of December.
Okay.
And actually, you've got legislative days in November, and then we will have a special meeting on December 2nd, I think it is. And that will be for the updated revenue forecast. And then as you come in February for the February session, in that second week, I believe it's the 15th, you will have another update. So you get two forecasts over the next
But we should have an economic forecast after the Federal Reserve Board meets.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then in the last section here, I just have some, what we typically do is try to put together a list of cleanup bills for you just to keep track of. These are potential committee bills as we look into the 16 session. And I've always thought one of the biggest advantages of the annual session is it does give you an opportunity to come in and deal with some of these things rather than waiting 2 years to make some of these technical changes. And certainly the first two, I think, fit in that category. You heard testimony from Department of Revenue in August about the really an inconsistency in the law, which occurred because of the switch from a refund back to a credit, but how donations to the state school fund are handled. And they went through with you how they were going to manage it. You were okay with that, but really we need to clean up that statute so it's clear direction for future kicker credits. The second issue is around food processing exemption. House Bill 3125, remember, came out of this committee right in the last few days. The Department of Revenue has some issues identified implementation issues, not policy issues, that can be, we think, can be fixed. And the last one is something that Chris will talk with you about today, and it's gotten a lot of publicity, is around the transferability of credits, particularly when there's a third party involved. You've established some pricing standards and statute, and the question is, how do those apply to these third parties in terms of how much a credit can be sold for? So those mostly have to do with the large business energy tax credits that are floating around for renewable energy, but they also potentially could affect some other transferable credits too. So that's a possible legislation to clarify that law. And Chris will talk about that with you today, and we also asked Kate Toswell from Council to be here. So those are the kind of the big issues, and where, of course, there are other things you want us to address and put on the list to deal with. We'll hand them.
Thank you. The report on from 2071 on the study says a report is due in December of 2015.
Yes.
So when you say you're going to have some things in 2016, what are those from? Are those just continuing carryovers?
Yeah, my anticipation is to have actual draft proposals based on those.
Okay.
So an actual language based on those.
Okay.
That was my understanding of the direction.
I think so. And then what will December look like?
Well, December, what we'll hope to have for you is further refinements to what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
And I can kind of fill you in kind of what our plans are, what we're hoping to accomplish between now and December. But we'll certainly have today. What you'll see is some kind of what I saw is really jumping off from where you ended the session, and kind of the bigger proposals you were looking at. So you can look at those kind of in the aggregate, and then we can definitely refine those between now and December for those. If we're both in November and December meetings, we could have something.
All right. And before we move on to OTIM, any questions on this update? Senator Booker?
Yeah, thanks. Paul, obviously the chair and I are going to become more familiar again with each other outside of these meetings. So is there a task force schedule here? I see that both Senator Haas and I are the automatic defaultees to another task force. And is there a meeting plan that you're going to put together for the chair and I so we know when and where we're supposed to be at these things well in advance?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. I've spoken several times with Ken Rocco. It's a joint staffing by LRO and LFO. So we'll send you some information and suggest some times and work out a kind of a work plan.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay.
One of the things that I thought might be helpful is to go back and a little bit of background about OTIM. There's a couple of things in your on the OLIS today in that regard. The first is just a kind of a summary that I put together, and then there's also an article in there for your reading enjoyment. State experiences with dynamic revenue analysis, which is out of the state tax notes that goes through and talks about the experience that states have had, including Oregon, and kind of where they are now. So I thought that might be useful. But I wanted to focus on the kind of the summary of OTIM, where we are. Just to remind you, OTIM has been around for a while. It was created in 1901, and we built it jointly with OSU in particular and the Washington State, but they had a professor on that was at OSU during that period. And we got a lot of help from the Department of Finance. Bruce Smith came up several times, and the OTIM is really largely the structure of it is built around the California DRAM. We, of course, went in and customized the parameters for Oregon to the extent we could, but it's based on that structure. Since that time, we've used it a lot to look at major proposals primarily. We have modified the base data on a fairly regular basis, and we went through and looked at the behavioral assumptions in detail in 2005, but we're undergoing that process right now, and I'll kind of tell you where we think we're at. So just to remind you what OTIM does and what its basis is that in effect what it does is it shows how the economy has responded to a change in tax policy. So it goes from one point in time, the current situation, and compares that to a future time after these behavioral effects have taken place. So while this is called dynamic estimation, It's really what economists would call comparative statics. There's one point in time with another point in time after the adjustments have taken place. That can be important because you're talking about a time period between when you change these policy tools and you see the results. And that time period will definitely vary depending on what stage of the business cycle you're at. If, for example, you enact a policy that reduces the cost of capital and you expect that to lead to investment, well, if we're in the middle of a deep recession, investment is not very responsive, no matter what the return on capital is, because you've got too much capacity. So those kinds of things have to be kept in mind. And I think some of the states, the classic example we've seen over the last few years has been Kansas, who enacted some large income tax reductions, anticipated a big behavioral response, and has ended up with very large deficits. So you just don't see those responses. And to the extent you do see responses, it tends to take time for that to occur and to actually affect your revenue stream, because you have to have economic actors change their behavior before it translates into changes in the numbers. One of the things about the article there that was interesting is that it does show what other states are doing. There are really an example of three states that have used what we call the CGE model, which is the computable general equilibrium model. California's DRAM that we based ours on. And the other is Nebraska is what they call the TRAIN, which is the tax revenue analysis in Nebraska model. So now we have OTIM and the TRAIN, which...
did we get corn with TRAIN? It's Nebraska, right?
Yeah, it's Nebraska, yes. Mm-hmm. And the TRAIN is still in use. They use it on an annual basis. They don't use it so much for revenue impacts as they use it for incidence analysis, and they have an annual report they put out with it. The DRAM has kind of fallen into disuse, largely because some of these models are expensive to maintain, and you have some of the key players left that are no longer at Department of Finance. The main activity of states has been around what's called the REMI model, which is a type of CGE model. It's regional econometric modeling incorporated. This is a company that's been around a long time. They have models of all 50 states, and states have been using these. I know Rhode Island went through a major use of this. And what they'll do is go through and customize their REMI base model for their own state. And then they use that as their tool to analyze behavioral changes. The biggest difference between REMI and our model is REMI is tied to their national forecast, so they build in a time path of those changes, which we just have these 2 points in time. So that would be a change. We have used REMI. We purchased REMI. And its most use that I'm sure you're most familiar with is it was the model used by NERC when they did the carbon study. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we certainly found at that point was you did have to go through and customize it quite a bit. There were some sectors in their model, like a sizable oil and gas sector in the Oregon economy that we knew didn't exist. So those kind of things can be done, and states have been working with them. Now there are 16 states that use REMI, at least they respond to a survey saying they do. In terms of our current activities, we have just completed, and it took more time than we had anticipated, updating our base distribution model, which is it's a combination of the updating the in-plan model, which is the economic base for the model, also has a distribution model component to it. But we matched that with the Department of Revenue income tax data and property tax data. That was the big push for us. It's the first time we've done that since 2001. So that's been a big...
Can I have a question, Chair? Paul, what is the impact of the new revenue base program? Is that going to have an impact on OTIM, the new program for the revenue department, IT?
Not directly. One of the things that issues that we have been working with the Department of Revenue, working with the fiscal office about, is to make sure that that's all of this data that we have, that we've gone over and collected the data, but we work in cooperation with the research division at the Department of Revenue. So we want to make sure that they maintain their ability to be flexible enough to get the kind of data that we need. And so that's something that we brought up with fiscal, talked to the revenue department, been assured that that will be maintained. So that is a concern of ours, yes.
Yeah, and it's a concern of mine as well, because the tables are different, and so it's going to be a different way to retrieve that data.
There are differences. It's just reporting differences about some of concerns they've talked to me about, how tax years are different, mm-hmm. the liability versus when the money comes in. Those kinds of issues are very important, as you know, in trying to mm-hmm. the data. So we're hoping to work through that. We did. It's always difficult doing these data matches. In fact, that's what's taken us longer than we expected. We wound up after the match with some very unreasonable results, and at least we thought they were unreasonable. We had a lot of people that didn't have had no income reported and paid a lot of taxes. And what we found out was that was great, I guess, but we found out that, you know, it was translation of those that didn't file electronically, just filed paper returns, and so they're coming through the federal data, and the federal data did not give us those components of income, so they added up a bunch of zeros and got zero taxable income and still recorded the tax liability. So we had to go through and fix all of those.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
So I would like you to kind of keep us informed on the, if there are any problems with the revenue, that the new tables getting translated properly and everything.
Senator, we'll definitely do that. Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, it's, you know, I think it's really a thing we've always emphasized, that we don't know, and we certainly don't know what your successors are going to want, what data they're going to want. So we have to maintain the flexibility to be able to respond to the committees, and your interests are going to change, the issues are going to change. Mm-hmm. So we can't just have some form report that we can't change.
And your questions,
well, I think we're all here for 18 months.
Your questions are, as chair of the Senate IT.
Yes.
Yeah. So we've currently gone through that. We're reviewing our behavioral assumptions now, and we have built those into our initial SIMS. We still are making some adjustments to that. We're also finalizing our base distribution. We've had a couple of meetings initially with an advisory group. We're planning another meeting with an advisory group to give us feedback on these assumptions around the base distribution and around the assumptions we have for these key behavioral elasticities. You know, and you can think of what the big ones are. I mean, there's a migration elasticity. A key one is labor supply. How responsive is labor supply to a change in after-tax wages? You know, those kind of assumptions are the key ones. So the last thing here, I've just got some strengths and limitations, and I think the article that I put on OLIS gives a good summary of that. They're skeptical, but yet, you know, there are clearly some advantages, and I think the key is you've put together a consistent model. I mean, you can always put together a model that's not realistic and get unrealistic results, but if you put together a consistently model, it's theoretically sound, and to the extent possible, it's based on empirical evidence, then I think you're going to get a pretty decent sense of what the trade-offs are, rough magnitude of changes are. And it also forces you to, when you're going to cut taxes, for example, it forces you to cut the government budget. So it's a general equilibrium model. You have to balance the budget. That's the point. And then if you change tax law, it has a feedback mechanism with federal tax. So if you cut state income taxes, okay, you have less to deduct on your federal returns. You're in effect transporting money to D.C. So those kinds of things are built in. But there's also, of course, a lot of limitations. And the specifics, you know, that this article emphasizes that they're not accurate enough to budget against. And that's probably true. And we deal with that with a sense that, well, if we have a change, let's say, in the 16 session, we would get estimates out through 6 years and build in the dynamic effects gradually over that time, so they wouldn't affect that current budget period, which I think is the safest assumption. So, and you can see what the others issues are, that you know, the timing issue I'd mentioned, and also that that a key assumption about any of these models is that they are based on what we call ceteris paribus assumptions. Everything else stays the same, that other states don't make similar changes or different changes that could affect that dynamic. So all of those limitations, I think, are important to keep in mind. Okay, so.
Well, I just, even with that caveat, it just amazes me how sophisticated and helpful this computer sampling is, and it always makes me ask the rhetorical question, is if we can be this precise with not just revenue figures, but economic outcomes, why don't we create a new tax code from scratch using this kind of precision? Plug in the principles that you want in your tax code, fairness, equity, and all those things, and then just say, okay, so let's set something up that's in sync with our economy, provides for growth, provides for educational outcomes, and start from scratch. We have the tools now that didn't exist 20 years ago.
Simple. Just like that.
The answer is, despite even all five of us or six of us who are thinking it's a good idea, we can't get our colleagues to vote yes. That's the problem.
That's exactly,
we went through this once already.
Exactly right.
Doesn't mean we're not going to do it again, though, Mr. Chair.
Well, I do think OTM is one of the least best-kept secrets in the building, so we look forward to these new figures.
Principles like fairness are elusive.
Right. All right, but if you ask the typical person why they don't like a tax, that's what they'll tell you.
I know.
It's a fairness. I don't think it's fair. So the next item I have here is the simulations themselves. And if you look in meeting material, we've got three of them. I'll ask Chris to come forward too. Has been working on these, and we also actually when we made the decision to go through and do a major update on OTIM, we hired Ed Waters, who was a former LRO employee and who was really the mastermind behind the original OTIM. He built a similar model for his dissertation at Oregon State in the Oregon economy. So he had real good background, and Ed has been working through this with us to kind of highlight things to look at and what differences are. So here's simulation number one.
Okay.
Ballot measure. You're ruining my day, Mr. Warner.
The first thing is that we just in terms of looking at some of the different distribution economic impacts of the proposals, we developed three that are revenue neutral. Okay, so these three are all revenue neutral in a static sense, you know, before the dynamic effect. So that's the goal here. So we didn't want to get that mixed up with overall impact on expenditures and overall government size. So the first one has about a 0.4 CAT, patterned after the Ohio CAT, and it goes into place 1-1 of 17. We do base all of these on 15 levels, just so you can get a sense of those relative numbers rather than growing them through time. And our personal income tax offsetting decrease is an increase in the standard deduction to 14,000 single, 28,000 joint. So a huge jump in the standard deduction. This would zero out a lot of taxpayers in the lower end. In fact, more than zero amount, as we found out. We had a lot of people that went into negative territory if they got the full deduction impact. The gross effect, annual effect in revenue of those two changes, the commercial activity tax about a plus 740, and then offset it with the standard deduction. So you're talking about $740 million between those two pieces, one positive, one negative.
Okay, just hold on here, just to keep it in perspective, we're creating a 0.4% commercial activities tax on corporations.
Anybody? Well, not on just corporations, on all entities. Just
on
as
all
the,
entities?
Yeah,
okay,
just as the Ohio tax is set up. So it's based on activities of, you know, any commercial activities. And it's a destination-based tax. So it's based on sales in Oregon.
Based on sales in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Is there a level that, is it all entities? Is there a minimum?
That we don't have a minimum built in. Ohio does have a minimum. Ohio has a minimum of $1 million.
Okay.
So, and what they do is they have a flat fee, I think it's $150, and then it's 0.26 of anything above $1 million. So, and that, you know, you could clearly construct it something like that. That doesn't have much effect on the revenue.
Okay, so we're going to raise $740,000 from that per year?
You're going to raise, yes, $740 million per year.
$740
yes.
million, sorry.
And that's
and
20, that's at the 2015 level.
Okay. And
so in other words, that would grow through time.
And the income tax cut, in effect, because of the deduction, is the same amount?
Yes, it's the same amount for its $740 million. For 2015 tax year.
Okay. All right, so that's what we have. This is our tax change here, revenue neutral. Can you or Chris will go down and tell us what the effects
yes, will I'll walk through those. Okay. I'll go through the ones that I noticed going through it, and then, you know, just let me know if there's any that you have questions on. The first thing to note is that even though this is not a net increase or net decrease, but it does have a positive impact on overall personal income. If you look at the top row there, personal income is up $892 million. So the stimulative effects of the standard deduction increase are greater than the contractionary effects of the CAT. And that's something that you've seen consistently, other simulations that an income tax has greater response than a consumption tax.
We've seen this in a lot of models. When you cut the income tax, it's a positive economic gain every time.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, even if you're offsetting it with a consumption tax of equal amount.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and you can see the reasons why as you look down the list. Employment overall increases by about 1.8%. So this would be an increase of about 47,000, and that's, again, after a five-year period. So that would be a little less than 2% increase overall employment. Population also increases, meaning you get in-migration into the state, and that's up by about 33,000. So you are, what that is telling you is you got more workers moving into the state, and you're also more intensely using your existing labor force. And all of that comes about through the wage index. If you look at the wage index, it's down about 1.3%, but that's the gross wage. That's the wage before taxes. What the standard deduction has done is it increased the wage after taxes. So that's where you get that response. That's the elasticity of the labor supply. So you get that increase, and you also have a complementary effect in investment. Is up by $81 million as you have more labor in the system. You have more investment, more capital as well. Return to capital is up slightly, and price levels are up slightly. So if you look at the revenue effects, the static effect is zero, and that's what we intended it to be. But because of the higher income, in particular, in the economy, you now have a $151 million dynamic effect resulting from that increased economic activity. So again, this would be after a period of adjustment. It wouldn't happen the next year. And, you know, if you were to carry out a policy like this, we wouldn't recommend budgeting against it next biennium. Mm-hmm. But it would give you a sense that when you compare these two equal-sized tax changes, that at least what the model is telling you is one has a greater stimulative effect than the negative impact of the one you've increased. So, you know, it gives you some relative magnitudes. Now, of course, the other issue that we always get is back to the fairness issue. And we can't measure fairness, that's in the eye of the beholder, but we can measure distributional effects. And we've gone through and modified our distributional groups, increased the amounts, and kept them at 9 of them. And you can see that the lowest group has a slight decrease of 0.1%, 10 million in that group. And the reason for that is that they get some impact from the CAT, from consumer prices that they have to pay, but they really don't get as much benefit from the full benefit of the lower standard deduction, because most of them, a lot of them, don't pay taxes now. So increasing their standard deductions certainly doesn't give them the full amount. So, and some of them that are paying relatively small amount of taxes are just zeroed out.
We're talking income taxes.
Yes, we're talking income taxes. Yeah.
They do pay other taxes.
They pay, yes. And we have estimates of all of that too, yes. And we try to estimate all the taxes, all the excise taxes, tobacco taxes, gas taxes. We have property taxes. You'll see some of the two property tax components in that. So then the other group that doesn't benefit or has a reduction in net income is the high end. We have above 205,000 is our highest end, and they also have 137 to 205. And the reason for that is that they're going to get some, bear some burden from the CAT, because that's going to, a lot of that income is capital income that goes to proprietors in that group, and they're going to feel the CAT increasing their taxes. At the same time, the top end gets virtually no benefit from the standard deduction, because they're still going to itemize. Because you can increase that standard deduction, you can up to 28,000, it's not going to affect their taxes at all. So what this has done is kind of benefited the middle group most of all, because they get the benefit of that bigger standard deduction, and the commercial activity tax is spread pretty widely across all the income groups. And again, the bottom line is you do have overall household income is up about $1.2 billion in this estimate. So you've got more income out there.
So there's more winners than losers here.
Yes. And then the other thing to keep in mind, there's not only more winners, there's more folks in general. And that's something that's important in terms of the revenue impact. You get $151 million more, but you also have an increase in households of 14,000. So in effect, you got more services to provide because as a result of that in-migration.
Paul, in questions, if in... And the increase in disposable income is pretty consistent. It's the difference between the 14,000 standard deduction and the present deduction now that is what?
It's about 2,000.
It's about 2,000.
A little over 2,000, yeah. It's index.
So what you're really doing is putting about 12 in these brackets on the right-hand column, for the most part, is you're putting about $12,000 in additional disposable income into a single person, or 24,000 into a joint recharge, correct?
Mm-hmm. But as you get out there, you've got people that now that we're itemizing get a big enough standard deduction where they'll start to use the standard deduction too. So they won't get that full amount, but they'll still get a gain.
But as a way to get working family money back into the working family hands.
Yes, it's well, you can see the groups that benefit here are really the 34,000 to 68,000 in particular.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Edwards had a question in there.
Senator Edwards.
Yeah, Paul, I know this is a summary, but can you elaborate a little bit on, if you know, how you would characterize the workforce that is in the in-migration number? I mean, when I think of in-migration due to economic activity, I think of everything from farm labor to high-tech workers. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we talking about?
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. I mean, the labor mobility would pick up those categories. In terms of the model itself, you get more higher mobility for higher income people. So that's both in terms of tax decreases and tax increases. So you get more people coming in from lower taxes and more going out at the high end in terms of mobility. At the low end, you still get a response. You have a labor elasticity that's a little bit less, but still you got a much bigger group out there. So you have a total bigger quantitative amount. The other thing we can show, we don't have, this model doesn't break things down by occupation, but it does break it down by industry. So you'd be able to see the all the industries and what the gains and losses were by industry from each one of these simulations.
That's a good question.
So, but you know, you get a lot of jobs in the service sector just from the population growth. You get that, that's the process that feeds on itself. You got more population, more jobs, more population.
47,000 new jobs over 5 years.
Well, this would say that after a five-year period, that you know our total jobs are around 1.8, 1.9 million. So you'd have 47,000 more under this estimate than we're projecting. So we always tie these numbers we use for any kind of a simulation would be these percent changes, and we would apply those to the latest forecast. So it's updated regularly with
Well, that's pretty impressive. The last time we dealt with a change or a freeze on corporate tax policy was in the Nike special session. And at stake in that special session was 500 jobs. Senator Boquist?
And Paul, clarify, because I think I'm correct. The 47,000 gain is a gain, 40,000 gain for implementation of this tax policy, and you would, in addition to that, have your standard population growth job increase too. So it's 47,000 above and beyond what we would normally have had, correct?
Yes, it would be 47,000 above the current law forecast, but it does build in the effect that you have a bigger population. So you've got growth coming from more intense use of your current labor force, and you've got more workers in the state.
But it's an increase over what we would have under the existing policy based on population growth. So if we're gaining $10,000-$12,000 jobs a year, we'd still gain that plus the 47,000.
Yeah, the idea of this is not a predictive model, but it's an impact model, so we would tie the impact model to the forecast.
Sounds like, Senator, you actually like this, even though you'd be in the bracket that would lose money on this.
I think I'm, these days, being a legislator and a farmer, I'm in the bracket that probably will.
We need our own bracket.
Yes, right.
I have a question.
Senator Bertschinger.
Paul, what's the margin of error in this model?
The margin of error, I think it's a simulation, so you're simulating what ifs. So you don't actually have an actual to compare with as you would with a forecast model, like we always talk about standard deviation and so forth. First of all, and I think with most all of our impact analysis, you have to break the error into two components. One is the different forecast assumptions. So in other words, if we're making this prediction and we turn out to have less employment than we do now, well, it may have been because the overall economy was in recession the whole time. Versus how much of it is due to the impact of this increment. That's very hard to do, but I think by looking at other states, and you can see some of the article, unless they're, frankly, some have been put together to try to advocate for a certain policy, and you get some real big effects. Most of them are in this neighborhood of 5 to 10% in terms of what the feedback is. These, you can see our feedbacks in our revenue analysis here. Average around, well, in this case, about 20% or so. So there's a kind of a 5 to 20% range in there for those feedback analysis.
I guess the reason I ask that is, the last session we just had this miscalculation in dealing with the transportation package of this huge percent. And I certainly wouldn't want to see something like that happen if we decide to go this way. Because once the train's left the station, you can't just say, oops, and turn it around.
Exactly right, yes. And, it's also very important to keep in mind that these are looking at an economic model that doesn't factor in things like how the new tax would be administered. So, for example, if Department of Revenue didn't have the ability to administer this change, you may end up collecting a lot less revenue than you theoretically could. So there's a lot of things that can affect these numbers. And I think that's why this article is good. It points out that you know, this gives you a sense of magnitude or the changes, the directions of changes of two different major changes, but it doesn't give you a precise estimate.
And Senator Bercher, we think LRO is better at this than ODOT.
Paul, could you hazard a guess at what this would look like if it was just the corporate tax and not an income tax cut? The economic benefits that's over here.
Mr. Chair, the corporate tax and...
Yeah, without the deduction change.
Oh, and to substitute that? Yeah. Well, that sounds like simulation number four.
Oh, okay.
Well, he's quoted in the newspaper on the R. Oregon ballot measure, so I'm waiting for that one to see what that looks like.
No,
oh.
No, I'm not. Okay.
So, but that would, yeah, that's something we could look at. My sense would be that
I guess it was a leading the witness question in that the tax benefits of cutting income taxes are pretty certain, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it mostly is going to affect your residents in the state. Yeah. So you're going to have that labor force effect, and you'll have some demand side effect. But the corporate tax has the advantage that it reduces the cost of capital, which makes Oregon attractive, more attractive relative to other states, you assume that they keep their policies the same. So we're saying that if you invest in Oregon, you get a higher net return. So that you do have a higher elasticity from that. On the other hand, when you change those corporate taxes, you have a lot of what is called tax exporting, because most of the owners of our major corporations, Intel, for example, aren't Oregon residents. They own equity in Intel. So, you know, that's so you don't get that direct effect on the Oregon economy on that side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul? The one thing I haven't heard you mention in this model is every time government does changes over here, the private sector changes over here. And you're not talking about what can the private sector do to offset what we're trying to do in this model. Have we explored that?
Well, Senator, I think what we're trying to explore and model is if we change our taxes, how does the private sector respond, right, given that those incentives? And so we build equations to try to predict how they respond, how workers respond to getting an increase in take-home pay, how consumers respond to having higher consumer prices or lower consumer prices. So that's what we're trying to build in. Certainly, I mean, the assumption around elasticity is how do you avoid taxes? Well, if you don't like the taxes in Oregon, you can move. And that, you know, we do build in those migration estimates. They're not huge. I mean, there's a whole series of reasons why people don't respond to marginal tax changes, but at some point they do. And when they do, then that, of course, affects the economy.
Okay.
Are you ready for number two?
I'm ready.
Okay. Simulation number two is similar. And again, we were designed these to be revenue neutral. So we had a little bigger CAT, which is about actually a little less than 0.5. So it's bigger than the other one. Raises about $900 million per year. And then we implemented a $125,000 homestead exemption. Again, we're talking about, you know, kind of high level economic effects. One of the things you'll notice right off the bat is the general fund gains a lot of money and the local governments lose a lot of money. So that would obviously require some adjustments between the state and local sectors. Yeah, the locals wouldn't like that. But if you look at the results of this, you can see that again, you have a net positive impact on the economy. The income effects are smaller than you had in your first example. But you have almost the same employment gains of about 41,000, a little bit less investment gains, and overall dynamic revenue effect is actually a little bit more at 181 million because you're getting this additional state activity that's being picked up, whereas the local governments have lost their homestead exemption. Now, or have gotten their homestead exemption. So what happens is you have a transfer in the investment sector. Keep in mind that investment, it's not just plant and equipment, it's residential construction. So that's where most of that investment would be coming, would be a response to an increased demand for home ownership because of the homestead exemption. And obviously you'd be zeroing out a lot of people through that large homestead exemption, zeroing out the property tax. So what the effect is for the state government is a gain of almost $1.3 billion, but a loss of about $1.1 billion in the local sector, but a net gain of about $181 million in revenue from the change. Now, you can also see how distributionally nearly all the groups benefit. Smallest benefits coming to the low-income group, not only in terms of dollars, but percentages. They tend to have lower home ownership rates, but we do see elderly concentrated in that group, particularly those lowest three groups. But at the top end, the effects of the CAT offset the gains from the homestead exemption. And if you look at our property tax distribution for residential property, the percentage does decline as you get to those higher groups because their wealth tends to be in other assets besides housing that are based on for the residential property tax.
You might have mentioned this, but this is homeowners.
Yes.
Only.
Yes. This would be. Yes. Homeowners only. It would be the owner-occupied primary residence. That's what the estimate is. Hoopers. So that gives you another one again. You would see some broadening of the base, and you'd also see that the impact on the property tax itself would clearly become more progressive because you end up zeroing out a lot of residential property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the property taxes go down, would we see rents go down?
Well, I think if you saw, you'd have an increase in the supply of housing, I think, to respond to that. I think it would depend on the interaction of the two. I think initially you would probably see rents go down as people would be wanting to go into the ownership sector. So you'd see a decline in demand for rental property as people would now, as this, the home ownership becomes relatively cheaper. So people move into home ownership and the demand for rental properties would go down. So, and then there would be, you know, obviously some supply response. You'd have a big increase in residential homes built. Or you'd have rental properties now become home ownership properties because more people can afford them.
This is a long-term trend. We've three times in the last 100 years seen a property correction, mostly the 30 percentile range. Basically, home value at $100,000, you know, loses 30% of its values. With a homestead deduction like this and the lower income homes, the first 125,000 exempted, you would have less of an impact if you had a market correction of that magnitude, would you not? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what the percentage of $125,000 homes are, but I mean, a 30% correction, and then it would also create more stability in your property tax program, mm-hmm. too, would it not?
It certainly would in dollar terms, yes. But, you know, whenever you go to a single bracket, you've gone from a single bracket to a two-bracket system where you got a zero and a positive out there. Mm-hmm. That means that when you go into a bust, a higher percentage of your property is taxed mm-hmm. at zero. And then when you go into a boom, it's a lower percentage. So you'd actually create more elasticity on your revenue. But obviously what you'd have to do in this case, where you're substituting a CAT, you're substituting a more stable revenue source in the system.
I'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
In
the theoretical, in the model here, it's 1.1 million. It's 1.1 million loss in local income, right?
Yes.
And the model theorizes here that you're going to transfer that 1.1 million back
yes.
to the local government? Is there a category that is clean to do that, like schools, like some other category? Or how would, as a revenue person, how would you envision that transfer?
Mr. Vice Chair, we've thought of several things. I mean, obviously you could shift some of the responsibilities like schools, which is nearly 40% of property tax collection, so you could do some restructuring that way. You also have a much smaller scale, but an example of where the state picks up the senior deferral property tax payments. Department of Revenue just pays the county if you're on the deferral. Mm-hmm. So you could work out a system like that. And that's basically what happened under the old property tax relief program, was the state used general fund money mm-hmm. and paid the local governments those property taxes, and in effect reduces people's property taxes.
Yeah, but that's not $1.1 billion.
It was not, it, but
$1.1 billion is a big chunk of change to figure out how to do it.
So yes,
that's it, the dynamic. That's
it is, but you also
to
have
get to 16.
Yeah, and it, that's true. But you have the cat revenue that's come in, and another option would be on the expenditure side is a lot of states will share, like sales tax revenue, for example,
right.
And you could construct a revenue sharing system okay. that turns it back to local governments based on population and
check
other
it.
Variables.
I'm certain you could construct something different. But again, here this creates 41,000 jobs, which is a huge economic burst.
Yeah.
And but that's predicated on cutting taxes, property taxes. Mm-hmm. Were it not for that, if it was just the corporate tax, you wouldn't see most of that.
Safe to say. Mr. Chair, I think it would be less of a stimulus type. We can certainly look at that, but you do get that the supply of capital. I mean, look at these regional models. Supply of capital is more elastic than supply of labor. So, and that makes sense. I mean, capital can flow wherever the highest return is. So you do get, you know, we have seen with things like investment tax credits, you do get a positive effect.
Thank you, sir. More bluntly, Dr. Warner, have you run an OTEM model on the R. Oregon ballot proposal, which is a total increase?
I have not, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see what that looks like.
I think that's in the works down the road.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
Number three and the last. This one is we tried to keep it within the property tax. And still, we're still looking at some of the modeling we've done around the non-residential property tax, but we're comfortable that these general results make sense, and that is where you would carry out something kind of roughly patterned after what we call the McIntyre proposal, where you would eliminate Measure 50 and go to real market value, and you would also incorporate, as you were looking at it during the session, a large homestead exemption. Again, ignoring some of the regional complexities and intergovernmental complexities, this change that we're looking at would, and these are, remember, Kyle's bar charts that showed what those would look like. This net change was about $363 million a year. So this homestead exemption was about $363, and then the revenue from a higher real market base on the remaining property would be about the same. So roughly offsets, you get a pretty substantial income increase, you get a smaller employment gain and population gain, you actually get a decrease in investment. And the reason for that is that, you know, this what you're doing is you're shifting the property tax burden away from residential onto non-residential. So that's primarily capital. It can be equipment, commercial, industrial capital that's used in the productive process. So they're paying a higher effective tax rate, and that's where you get the negative effect on investment from the change. And that overall change, you can see, does end up pushing down the static effect to zero and does give you a small but still significant, I think, dynamic revenue impact that's negative. So what we're saying is, when all is said and done, the state would gain about $98 million through general fund, other fund, and the local government would lose about $141 million. So you'd have a net negative there. and those dynamic effects. Of course, the state picks up that higher income money that they collect, while the locals lose money from both the homestead exemption and also the dynamic effects on the on residential capital.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And does this take into account, since we're talking about this tax on equipment and so on, does this take into account the SIPs and stuff that we have?
Senator, this is modeled at a high level, so we've taken what the average effective tax rate is for that category. So we haven't broken out specifics on the semiconductor industry and that kind of thing. So, but it is factored in the sense that it impacts the current level.
Got it. Thank you.
So, Paul, this is almost revenue neutral.
Yes.
It looks like, you know, if the homestead exemption were 190 or 180, somewhere in there, that you would almost hit it. Is it fair to do a calculation like that? That would, mm-hmm. That's what you'd have to do? Or?
Well, you would end up with a static. See, it is revenue neutral. It's a static effect.
Uh-huh.
But it's the dynamic part that makes it negative.
And I'm sure Don's watching. I can smell the tobacco, the cigar smoke.
You'd be proud.
Yeah, he just started out of double dickies.
We've talked about this model quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the number is 150. Or
And on the distribution side.
A question down here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Edwards.
I was just wondering, what's the, I didn't catch what the horizon is for this analysis.
We would implement this for 1/1/2017. See at the top. So
yeah, I saw that.
So if we're using our standard assumption, it would be a 5-year period where you'd feel those dynamic effects.
Okay.
Now, if we went through and you passed a bill like this, the way we would score it is we would take this $42 million impact and we'd spread it over 5 years. So we'd say the 20% occurred in the first year, 40%, 60, 80, up to the $40 million. And we'd adjust the revenue impact out on those future biennium by that amount. So the last point here is, again, on the distribution side. And again, you see that our high-income folks do have a negative effect, both in number of households and in the difference, although their mean household income stays the same, so this means they're responding throughout migration. And the reason for that is that they, again, are recipients of that capital income, that non-residential property tax income is that kind of business capital income. And remember your study, the Council State Taxation Study on business income comparing the states. The number one tax, state and local tax, paid by businesses is property tax. Number two is sales tax.
Observations, comments, questions? Senator Edwards?
What I'm struggling with is what is included in the OTIM model and what isn't. So that's why I asked about the horizon of the analysis, because while there's clearly there's a stimulative effect in many regards, what got me to think about this was Senator Boquist's question about ballot measures that are out there and the analysis on those. And if you have a big, you know, it seems to me that how the legislature, what the legislature does with the revenue affects the numbers too. I mean,
well,
you know,
course.
Free community college, I mean, that could be a game changer for a lot of families and completely kind of changes all of this. So, I mean, that's what I'm struggling with is just like, as, you know, business as usual spending in the current, you know, ratios of however we spend and the output into the economy of that versus, you know, a big shot in the arm with a lot of revenue that goes into something like, you know, community college or, you know.
That is a very important question, very important issue. I mentioned earlier that one of the advantages of the CGE models is that they do require a balanced budget. So if you're going to cut taxes, the model, what it does is it just have across-the-board cut in government spending. So now that, I tend to think of that as that's really the demand side effect. Mm-hmm. So it does pick that up and does account for that. So you have, if you look at the detail, you have less state government workers and so mm-hmm. forth when you have a tax cut.
Right.
And that all makes sense. But the education or the expenditure module in the model is pretty simple. The taxes, we have all the major taxes, we have those modeled explicitly. But the expenditure side, we have education, we have non-education. Hmm. So it's very aggregative. And it's those, we have a built-in mechanism so that those changes in those expenditures can affect the productivity of the economy, mm-hmm. have real supply side effects. Mm-hmm. And we've always assumed that would make, why else would you invest in education? Mm-hmm. I mean, you invest in education, you get an increased, more productive labor force. So over time, that should increase not only output, but output per hour. So all of that, I think, is theoretically sound. Where we've been stopped is, number one, we think that the feedback effects from those benefits would be a longer time period than the tax
right.
effects. And it's probably going to take more than 5 years, obviously, yeah. you know, early childhood education or something. And they're variable, depending on the specific program, and we don't see very much good empirical evidence of what the magnitude of those changes are. Now, we got into this when the legislature approved 66 and 67 and looked at some different assumptions behind that, and that's certainly true. If you make a more aggressive assumption about the impact of government spending on productivity in the economy, you can offset a lot of the negative effects from a tax increase. But that, you know, that depends on how, as you say, right. depends on how those dollars are used, not only in the program area, but how efficiently they're put in place.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that expansion.
Yeah, that's a big question.
Question: $2.5 billion a year.
Senator Boquist.
Oh, gonna get interesting.
It is interesting. It's three simulations, all of which show significant employment gains, significant tax savings for mostly middle-class taxpayers without significant revenue hits to the state and, in some cases, revenue gains.
And I've warned the committee, I think, during the session, this could be addictive.
Yes, I can see. You know what would be interesting is if you ran a simulation where nothing changes. We just keep the status quo and see if you just see how that comes out. And I know you won't have the employment gains or the tax savings.
Well, in a sense, though, that's what your forecast is. I mean, that's saying current law stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then really what drives that mostly is the national forecast.
Okay, look at something.
Yes. Okay.
That was exciting.
Yeah. All right.
I'll have to think about it.
Tax credit transfers.
That's Chris. Well, this is an issue that Chris has been working on, and we had it on our list of possible legislation, but Chris has put a lot of time in this, and he's, in fact, over the years spent quite a bit of time with Betsy in general. So.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And so as Paul set up the tax credit transfers, I wanted to provide a little bit of context for the members who have not had the joy of dealing with these over the past 5 to 7 years.
I'm going to the restroom.
And right now, I use the term active credits. And these are tax credits for which we can have new claimants for the tax credits. And currently we have about 30 active tax credits, and there are about four that are able to be transferred. So I wanted to start off in talking about the policy considerations and why a tax credit might be transferable. And by transferable, it is in statute where a person does something to earn a tax credit or by dint of their characteristics, they have a tax credit. And if they are then able to sell or transfer the credit to an unrelated party, and then that person can claim it on that person or corporation can claim it on their tax returns. So some of the reasons for transferability, at least that we've used so far, are for investment funding and for tax-exempt entities. So Betsy has been the biggest one, and there are a couple of other energy tax credits. And basically, these are entities that undergo some sort of energy-saving project. They earn a tax credit, and there is a five-year payback for some of the – it's a five-year credit. So, for example, Betsy was claimed over 5 years, and under current law, there's a conservation tax credit where the tax credit is statutorily claimed over 5 years. So the entity that earns the tax credit is able to claim it over those 5 years, but in some cases they would rather sell the tax credit immediately and get that upfront money in that first year. So for some of those investment purposes, that's one reason a tax credit might be transferable. Another would be a tax-exempt entity. Some governments or nonprofit entities could undertake some of these activities, get a tax credit, but then for obvious reasons they couldn't use it. So the legislature has made these tax credits transferable. Within this discussion, the issue of refundability comes up. And just to refresh people's memories, a refundable tax credit is one where an entity can drive their tax liability down to zero, and if they can still get a refund for the tax credit. So if I have my pre-credit liability is $500 and I have a refundable tax credit of $750, I can eliminate my tax liability down to zero, and then I can get the $250 back. One of the differences there is the timing of when that revenue impact would hit the state. The refundable tax credit would occur in that first year as opposed to the multi-year tax credits. The type of entity I touched on, and in different times, I'm still doing a little bit of research on to nail some of the pieces of this down, but from a policy perspective, the notion of transferable could be applicable to certain kinds of entities. For example, for tax-exempt entities, the state could make tax credits transferable only for tax-exempt entities, but not for for-profit entities. Another possibility to deal with the transferability issue is this notion of the state buying back the tax credits. So rather than having the ability for taxpayer A to sell the tax credit to another entity, the potential exists for the legislature to set up a program where the state could just buy back the tax credit at some predetermined rate. And the last overarching issue here are administrative issues. The state over time, we've had half a dozen or eight tax credits that have been transferable. We are down to four. The issue of how uniform these would need to be is another policy consideration, because the administration of transferable credits could be centralized so that it's through one department. Department of Revenue's name often comes up, or they could be tailored depending on the state agency that administers the tax program relative to that tax credit. So these are just some high-level policy considerations and trying to address the question of why we deal with transferable credits anyway, some of the things that have been talked about in the past. The tax credits that we have on the books that are transferable are these four tax credits: the agriculture, workforce, housing, construction, biomass, energy conservation, and the transportation projects. Items three and four there are the offspring of Betsy, so to speak. And all four of the, definitely items two through four are part of the tax credit cycle that Paul talked about at the beginning of the meeting today. And the first item may be part of that report as well. One of the exceptions that we've included into these reports is if there's a significant amount of lead time for a tax credit. If some investment needs to occur, sometimes these tax credits get reviewed the session ahead of cycle. And I've highlighted in yellow here the language that's on the books about how the tax credits are transferable. And to the extent that this language varies across tax credits, there's some potential for different interpretation of what the legislature intends by to what extent they are transferable. For example, the agricultural housing construction tax credit can be transferred to contributors. Now, these are entities that are financially tied in one way or another to these projects that are undertaken. The biomass tax credit is pretty broad. It just says it can be transferred to a taxpayer subject to the income tax or the corporate excise tax. And then the other two have similar language around transferring the tax credits. So these are the ones that we can get new taxpayers claiming in any one year. And other statutes I just wanted to bring to your attention is this renewable energy resource. This is the Betsy tax credit. And this statute there talks about the net present value, that the potential tax credit can be sold for the net present value at the time of preliminary certification. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And the other two statutes here, 315.052 and 315.053, were laws that were passed in 2009 that limited the transferability of tax credits. They aren't limited to any particular tax credit. 315.052 simply says that a transferable credit can be transferred only once, unless expressly stated otherwise by statute. And then 315.053 says a tax credit can only be transferred to a C corporation, an S corporation, or a personal income taxpayer. Now, some of the issues that have arisen in the media recently pertain to how these statutes fit together. And under one interpretation, there is one for the energy tax credits, there's one pass-through program. And so an eligible entity would come in for their project, they'd get the pre-certification, and at that time they would indicate that I don't expect to be able to use the tax credit, so I'd like to participate in the pass-through program and sell my tax credit. Another interpretation that has come up is how some of these statutes fit together and whether or not taxpayers who get a final certification for the project can then sell the tax credit at that time. And it has to do with how these statutes fit together. And I think Kate Toswell from Ledge Counsel is here if you want to have any particular legal questions about how those statutes would be interpreted. But that's one of the issues that has really come up in how these statutes fit together and whether the legislature intended a single transfer program or multiple transfer programs, where the single transfer program would be, for example, there under Betsy, that it can only be sold for the net present value as determined at the time of pre-certification, and by the formula that is there under right through here. It actually gives rulemaking authority to the Department of Energy to create a formula. And in a few minutes, I have the formulas in here, and I'll discuss those briefly. So that's really one of the questions before the legislature, and potentially one of the issues you may want to deal with in 2016 is clarification, whether or not there is one transfer program or two transfer programs, or exactly what parameters or sideboards you want to put on the transfer of tax credits. So given the issue right now about whether or not taxpayers can sell tax credits at the final certification stage, there are about $44 million in tax credits right now that potentially could be affected by the interpretation of current statute or any changes that might be made in 2016 or clarifications made in 2016. So this is information I got from the Department of Energy, and they have $44 million in tax credits that are for conservation programs or conservation projects and transportation projects, and it's split about in half between private entities that are undergoing these projects and government or nonprofit entities that are undertaking these projects. Most of these are still identified as pre-certs, meaning the projects haven't been final yet. But the potential to sell them would really focus on the government and the nonprofits, because the governments aren't going to be able to use.
Senator Boquist?
Yeah, that was my question. Why did we do this again? Harvin, you're out, but the three of us were here. That was way back when we did this the first time. I mean,
yes.
We basically created a cash cow for government and nonprofits.
Is that
the intent of the legislature at the time, or is it just how it worked out?
Well, I think the intent was that to promote, these are programs that started under an energy savings goal.
Right.
And so if, from, I think the intent was that it doesn't matter if it's a private entity or a public sector entity, if they undertake these projects, they would be eligible for the tax credit. And clearly government entities can't claim the tax credit, so then that brought out the need to make the tax credit refundable. And it was just made refundable for all entities. I mean, not refundable, transferable.
Sake of stepping all over myself here, because I was here when we passed a lot of this stuff the first time around. And I don't recall any of the government. The whole object was trying to get the private sector to invest and put the incentives in for the private sector. I don't remember any discussion about we're going to incentivize government to do something and then create a cash cow and a new tax revenue source.
I think part of the discussion now is to visit that purpose and to revisit that explicit discussion about what parameters do you intend. And what would you like in statute, to be as clear as possible?
Well, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, the problem with this I see is that the government entities, whoever they are, still want the money too. So therefore, this is, it's not just a case of looking at the private sector and saying, okay, yeah, we should have done it this way. You've got some sort of government entities that are there that have this, and they're anticipating selling this too and generating revenue themselves, I would assume, or they wouldn't have got into it.
That's part of the argument around the tax credit, because they undertake the planning for these projects, and presumably they account for the sale of the tax credit. Now, at exactly what price, when they are in the pre-cert stage, the Department of Energy is, since 2012, required to have a formula for determining the sales price of the tax credit, and that's what Energy refers to as the pass-through program. So if you have a school district who's considering undertaking a project that might be $1 million tax, that would result in $1 million tax credit, they could look at that formula and realize they could sell it for X dollars, and that would be part of the planning about whether or not they undertook the project.
Follow, Mr. Chair. But of the four different tax credits, there really is at least two different versions of how you calculate the value of that tax credit, if I recall back to your first page there. Because you have one. The owner may retract your exchange for cash equal to the present value. That's, of course, supposed to be set by rule by the Department of Energy, right? And then you go back up at the present value.
Right. So that
that's pretty loose interpretation. What is the present market value of a tax credit? That's hence relies 1 through 3's credit issues, right? And what's
partly
the dollar value
yes.
associated with the four of these? Do we have a breakdown of the cost of each one of these errors we made?
The total cost for the tax credit?
For 1, 2, 3, and 4 up there.
Yeah, I didn't bring that with me for the. I mean, we have that information. Right. I can get that to you. But that's. I mean, you've touched on the notion of the formula for the determining the net present value. Now, when the legislature was discussing this, there was a back and forth about how tight to be in statute versus flexibility. Because if the legislature spelled out exactly what the formula would include, then that might be too rigid. And in where the legislature landed was that the Department of Energy would create a formula and update it on a quarterly basis and would incorporate inflation projections and market real rate of return. And so
Sid Riley, did you have a question?
Yeah, and this is all before we thought about the difference between the sale through the department and through private entities, and the different discounts. Are you going to discuss that?
Yeah, and that's the core issue around how the statutes are interpreted. We have the specific statutes for every tax for these tax credits that says this one is transferable, and a couple of these they can only be transferred by a formula determined by the Department of Energy, because the legislature gave energy rulemaking authority. The question is how that statute is interpreted in conjunction with 315.052 and 315.053.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a question of legislative intent around whether the plan was to allow for them to be transferred only at the time of pre-cert, basically at the beginning as the project is being undertaken, so they could enter the what has become known as the pass-through program, and they could sell it at the rate determined by the formula, and the formula set by the Department of Energy. What has come up since then is this alternate interpretation of statute that, and this is where it can get a little bit tricky,
yeah,
about other statute means that taxpayers can sell the tax credit anytime they want.
Follow up. And my belief in what the intent was, and again, I was around for some of this, and I believe that we set those formulas, or we said, here's the formula, and you can sell it any time, but you still have to follow the formula. Now, that was what I think, and what's happened is the DOE has said, if it's a private entity, you can sell it for whatever you want. And I don't think that was ever the intent, was to allow them to sell it for whatever they want.
Was there a question there?
No.
Can you confirm that sentiment, that opinion?
I think Ledge Council is here to, because I don't want to stray into any legal interpretation. But part of the argument, I think, behind the one view that you expressed was focusing on 315.052, that a tax credit could be transferred only once.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ledge Council is here if you'd like to ask her her interpretation.
Yeah. Well, just as she's coming, Mr. Chair, I'm with Senator Roddy, because, I mean, we had these discussions when we passed this stuff, and the idea was the whole purpose of the deal was trying to get the capitalization for this.
Right.
And whether you sold it, you had a set value, and whether you sold it now or used it as a financing mechanism to sell it later to finance the project, that was the whole bloody intent of these tax credits.
Right.
I mean, and that's how it was sold on both sides behind the scenes, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm Kate Toswell from the Office of Legislative Counsel. And I'll tell you a little bit about statutory construction and then specifically about these statutes. When a court is looking at a statute and determining its meaning, the statutes in ORS Chapter 174 provide that legislative intent is paramount. And in conjunction with the statutes, there's also case law. There's PG versus Boley, and then there's a more recent case, State versus Gaines. And they set out what the procedure is for statutory construction and, by its very nature, determining legislative intent. And under Gaines, we look first at text and context of the statute, and then if there's ambiguity, the court can inspect legislative history, and if a party introduces legislative history, they can do that. And then if there's still ambiguity, the statutory maxims of construction can be used. So Gaines, in a way, relaxed the procedure and said that legislative history can come in earlier. Under PG versus Boley, it was viewed as a step-by-step process. So going back to looking at specifically the energy tax credit statutes, there have been changes pretty much in every session going back to 2007.
Yeah.
And there is this language dealing with the pricing formula. And that language is found, or variations of that language are found throughout these statutes. And that language was amended in 2009. Two things happened. One, I think, has already been discussed, where the description of the formula, which uses inflation projections and market real rate of return, that concept was introduced. The other thing that was introduced was the shift from use of the term may to use of the term shall, making it mandatory rather than permissive for the Department of Energy to use those formulas. So looking at that, and then also looking at the rest of the statutes, both the statutes in ORS Chapter 315, which are the credits themselves, and then also looking at the statutes in 469B that set out the administrative provisions, it seems to us, and it's our position, that the use of the word transfer and the restrictions on transfer saying that a credit may be transferred only once, which is in 315. I believe it's 051, which also came in 2009. Mm-hmm. Combined with the restrictions as to what type of entity can be a transferee, if you read those all together, you don't see that there is a separate type of transfer. In other words, there's one type of transfer, mm-hmm. and if a court, either the Oregon Tax Court or the Oregon Supreme Court is looking at this, they're going to say, for one thing, these are statutes that have been amended in pretty much in every session. There was reorganization. There were new credits that were introduced, but they were basically descendants of the original, the so-called Bessie credit. But that there have been changes in each session. And throughout those changes, there's been restriction and sort of amplification of the need for the credits to be basically controlled. Well, so it seems to us that a court is going to say if the legislature intended to set out these two separate types of transfer programs, the legislature would have the ability to use those words. And in looking at the first step under Gaines or under PGE, the use of the word transfer, there would be another term and also presumably another statutory scheme that would be set forth saying under this other type of transfer, there's no, the market pricing doesn't need to, there doesn't need to be a formula, or it's a private transaction that's not covered by this.
So to clarify, do you believe that the statute allows those private sales at a different rate than the formula?
Senator Riley, Chair Haas, our interpretation is that it's doubtful. We don't, in looking at these statutes, we don't think that's accurate. And one piece I would add is the idea that a private sale is somehow outside of this process. There's a body of case law dealing with tax credits and tax incentives as the term is legislative grace, something that's given by the legislature and that can also be taken away or modified by the legislature. In other words, not necessarily just a piece of tangible or intangible personal property that you can sell at whatever price the parties set.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Just a couple of clarification. I have sponsored legislation every single session since 2000, since Chuck and I came in every year, and it has not passed because the courts don't like it. Identifying legislative intent, because the problem with legislative intent in the court process is first the court can, that's the word you use, which is correct. It does not, the word shall is not in there, and it can use any sort of legislative intent from they talked about it in the halls to the staff measure summary or any place that's out there. The second problem that comes with legislative intent is that it has to be presented by someone. So either the Attorney General has to take this case to court, as we were saying, because you made several references, well, the court will do this. Well, that means the state's in a lawsuit, which is what we're trying to prevent here, okay? Is that whole process means how good is the lawyer making the presentation, how good is the lawyer on the opposite side, and who's trying to bring it into play. So the legislative intent, you know, for our purposes, is what did we intend back there in 2007, and how did we screw the bloody thing up, and now how do we fix it and change the law so it's very clear, as the last three Supreme Court Chief Justices have said, what does the word of the law say? And so, to me, it's like, okay, Houston, we do have a problem here. I just don't know politically how you can fix it, because you have both private entities and government entities into this mix now. But it's a mess.
Yeah, if I may. But what I just heard was the LC's belief is that the law is not being followed when they talk about private sales at different than the formula rate.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with the good senator. The word that strikes me is doubtful and legislative intent. So yeah. It seems to me
I know.
What we're trying to do is get rid of doubt and make it clear.
Yes.
And establish reestablish legislative intent would be the goal there. Other than that, Dr. Warner wouldn't have brought it to us. so that it's very clear that there is no doubt and this is the legislative intent in the word of the law.
Yes.
That's what we're going to do.
Let's do it.
All right, Kate. Thank you.
Except if it's Pandora's box.
Yeah.
Everything from this committee is.
So the last thing.
It's the ghost of Betsy.
Right. I'm not saying for or against, Mr. Chair. I'm just pointing out the blinding flash, the obvious.
So then, unless there are any questions on any of the revenue impact, well, not, they're not really revenue impact numbers, but the potential tax credits between the private and public sectors and how they might affect the revenue stream over time. The last thing I just wanted to touch on was the formulas. I'm not going to go into the detail here other than the big picture of the sales price for the tax credits. The blue line is the history of the energy, the energy formula based sale price for the 1 year tax credit, which you can see has been around 97-98% for the past several years. Each of these is a quarterly update. The red line represents the sales price, if you will, for the 5 year tax credit. And so right now, it's about 80%. You know, you can sell a 1 year $1,000 tax credit for $977 through what is referred to as the pass-through program. This isn't the other aspect of selling it after final certification. Or you could sell a $1,000 5 year tax credit for $815. And so there have been, I've heard some examples about the concern about the price of the tax credits, but the result of the formula is that right now it's about 80%. And the formulas, and I got these off the Department of Energy website, to abide by statute, they're including in here the treasury yields, either a 2 year treasury yield or a 5 year treasury yield in their formula, and then a change in the consumer price index for the urban west region is how they're incorporating those two aspects, which are in current statutes. And you can see how the 5 year has changed over time. It was as high as 97%, but is now at about 80%. It's been that way since about the end of 2013.
Chris, if we determine we're going to delve into corrective legislation, I'm assuming since the government entities are government entities, that we can identify who those are. I mean, the individual taxpayers, based on tax code, might not be able to identify. Is that not correct, Mr. Warner?
Yeah.
But the government entities, we ought to be able to identify who those are since they aren't taxpayers and those are public records. Is that correct?
We should be able to. And there is a difference between certification information and tax return information. It's the tax return information that is really caught up under the C felony statutes. The certification, I'd have to check, but I believe there is no confidentiality around the certification process. So with a footnote, I believe we can get a list of the projects.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to figure out so we know who the stakeholders are. So if we do something that it's, you know, we're fair and equitable and we bring everybody into the matrix and say, okay, this is the way we would fix this, so that we'd know who those entities were, instead of just random people coming up here and testifying. Like Google, Yahoo, the rest of those people.
There's those pesky words again, fair and equitable. Okay.
That was all the points that I wanted to touch on. Just again, context for the controversy at hand.
Okay.
Doom and gloom.
Let's close out this agenda item and move on to something easier, like property taxation of nonprofits.
Yeah, in your wildest dreams, Mr. Chair. Easier. God. Good luck.
You guys tag teaming this, Paul? Or
Mr. Chair, Kyle has done the work on this, and this is, of course, a remnant of the 15 sessions, something you talked about at the end of the session, and we've started the process, what we think is going to take the entire interim to start to develop something that would be the comprehensive look at the existing statutes, and Kyle spent a lot of time with Department of Revenue and the assessors and working through some of the information. Okay.
So good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, as Paul was just saying, what I plan to do today is just to kind of bring you up to speed on an interim project that we've been working on so far this summer related to the taxation and exemption of nonprofits. And with most of the specifics, really diving into a single exemption right now is the initial plan. But what I want to do today is just to talk about a little bit about the project, what we expect the outcomes to be. We do think of this as an interim project with the outcome coming prior to the 2017 legislative session, so probably be a paper. And then also as kind of a second part of my discussion today, we'll be giving a little bit of background on the legal structure of the exemption, if you will, some of the background of how we got to where we are today, and then also I'll briefly touch on some of what the other states are doing in this area. But so I would mention also in the meeting materials on OLIS, it is the last item in the meeting materials. I do have a little 7-page pamphlet in there that you can take a look at.
Only 7 pages.
7 pages.
Just try to keep
That's
it short.
That's the executive summary, Kyle?
Yes, well, and I would mention this is not the report itself. I plan to have at least 75, 80 slides for the full presentation.
You said pamphlets, so it's a trifold or something.
Right. He and Patrick Henry.
But yes, so the scope of the study, as you know, there are more than just one exemption for nonprofits. However, we were planning to focus on the exemption that's commonly referred to as the Literary, Charitable, and Scientific Organizations exemption. That's ORS 307-130. And that's the one the committee has heard probably more about over the past few sessions. And there's a couple bills I'll bring up later on just to kind of remind the committee of some of the issues that were brought up this last 2015 session. But before I get down into the detail, and I apologize, this is probably a little small to see up on the screen, but this is the full listing of all the nonprofit property tax exemptions, or at least the ones specific to nonprofits. So, of course, there could be other exemptions nonprofits could receive, but these are ones specific to nonprofits and not available to all entities. I have in the chart there's a listing of the tax expenditure number. These are all in the governor's tax expenditure report. The statute reference providing the exemption, the name in the statute, and then also the estimated revenue loss that's in the most recent tax expenditure report, the published estimates for the 15-17 biennium. And I've organized them as beginning with the largest estimated revenue loss, which is the 307-130, the Literary, Charitable, and Scientific Organizations exemption. And that's followed by the exemption for religious organizations. Then you have 307-145, which is certain child care facilities, schools, and student housing. Skipping down one, you then see the exemption for nonprofit corporate low-income housing, and then the property of fraternal organizations. And after that, the exemptions start to get smaller. Your fraternal organizations about $15 million a biennium, and then you start to fall down into some relatively small revenue loss estimates. But I bring up those five because those encompass, in a lot of the literature I've been looking at, when you talk about nonprofit just in general, not necessarily the exemption, you hear about, a lot of times it's categorized into, in no specific order, you'll see things for education nonprofits, healthcare hospitals, nonprofit, low-income housing or housing-related, and then there's often another category that could be all sorts of community benefit and those type of things. And you can see in statute there is some of those that are already specific, such as religious organizations, but the 307-130 is a broader exemption than it's capturing charitable entities, so nonprofit charitable entities. So it's that broader exemption, and because of that broadness, it can create some potential issues, and those are ones we'll be bringing up a little bit later for some of the rationale behind the study. But so what we expect, kind of an overview of the outcome or the results that we plan to present, is really it is meant to be a study. It's not the idea of the study is more to lay the groundwork of what does it look like today, what's the environment today, give some background on how we got here. But it's not necessarily going to answer the question, or it's not even going to attempt to answer the question of whether these are a good policy, whether the exemption's a good policy. It's more, let's just talk about the size of the exemption, what it is made up of, some of the issues on the administrative side, and so on and so forth. And the ultimate end goal is to be able to inform legislative members and any potential work group of this kind of these bedrock issues, if you will, the foundational issues. And then on kind of our side, on the LRO side, is to also work with the county assessors to build the necessary data to simulate or model any potential changes or policy option changes or anything like that. So right now today, the data on this exemption is extremely aggregate. So what the Department of Revenue uses in making estimates for the governor's tax expenditure report is a single, more or less a single line item that is received from each county that is for the entire charitable exemption. So breaking that down then requires a different level of data that we don't have and maintain. It's something we have to work with the county assessors on, and that can take some work because there's 36 county assessors, and the way that it's shaped can take a little time to work with. So that's something we plan to do in the interim as well, is to build a data set that allow us to do that. So what I'm going to cover today, I have kind of a list of what we think the report will cover, but I'll cover a little bit of the legal overview. The administration of the exemption, this is something we actually, so we have talked with them. We met with, earlier in the summer, we met with the Association of Oregon Assessors, Department of Revenue, and then also it was the Association of Oregon Counties as well. And to kind of talk through a little bit of the scope of the study, but also find out some of the information that's out there. The committee members may remember the Association of Counties Assessors were before the committee during the 2015 session to discuss. They had their own work group already relating to this statute, specifically, or more specifically, in the hospital areas, trying to unpack that a little bit. But so we reached out to talk to some of the policymakers and the administrators of the exemption to find out what's already out there and available, and about how this work, to work with them on how this work will go forward. And one of the things we found out about was the Department of Revenue actually has a survey out right now with county assessors that will be coming in later this fall, tracking some of the administrative costs and effort that goes into just making sure that applying the exemption, more or less. So hopefully Department of Revenue has been kind enough to offer to share those results with us. So hopefully that'll be contained within the final study as well, some qualitative or quantitative information describing some of the admin costs. And the final bullet I have there under the exemption is really, the way that I see this is almost an unpacking of the exemption. And that's, we have one large exemption right now, but let's break it down a little bit and see some of the component parts. I will hit on briefly what we see in other states, but as a final end result, also being able to look at maybe some case studies of some other states. This is a widespread exemption throughout all 50 states. So what can be learned from other states is something that we'll definitely include there. So the rationale for the study, it's not a surprise, I think, to the committee members, and especially after the last session as well, there was, and Paul mentioned this at the beginning of the committee meeting today, is the potential inconsistencies in administration and qualification for the exemption. So it's a broad exemption. It's not all that many words for as broad as it covers, I guess. So it's not as specific as maybe it could be. And because of that, there can be various interpretations and administration of the exemption. So one of the issues that the committee had become aware of is areas where a nonprofit that maybe is organized the same as similar property in County A and County B, you would expect them to receive an exemption in both County A and County B, or not receive the exemption in both County A and B. And there have been instances where there's some inconsistency between the counties. So finding out how widespread that is and then trying to address that would be one of the scopes of the study. Also, reducing administrative costs or litigation, that's something the county assessors were here and discussed about. As for them, they say bright line is the term they use a lot, where it makes it a lot easier for them to not have to try to identify what is charitable, what is not. But if there's a bright line there, they can say, yes, you meet it, no, you don't, we know what the statute intent is. And by having that, not only would the admin costs possibly go down today, but it'd be more probably more likely that it's the chance of litigation that could be reduced, which is a big thing for the assessors. And then the last component I have there is potential policy changes. And I have a couple examples that discuss, that kind of tie into the policy change from the 15 legislative session. House Bill 2690, this was an exemption for nonprofit home builders building low-income housing. And if bring the committee back a few months, originally, one of the issues here was that nonprofit home builders were finding inconsistent treatment based upon which county they were located in. So the first question was how to address that. And the initial draft, or the initial introduced version of the legislation, was working within 307.130, where the exemption is being received today. By the time the bill passed, and the enrolled version actually removed that terminology from ORS 307.130 and put it into its own, what will be its own statute. And some of the reason for that was trying to build in an exemption that's broad right now and is received by a number of different nonprofits, trying to make different sideboards or different qualification criteria or make it flexible enough to account for a certain type of business practice of a nonprofit can be difficult if you're also affecting a larger group of nonprofits as well. So the solution there was to remove it from the statute and build it in outside its own statute, which does technically create another property tax exemption. But it's one example of how to go forward and also illustrates the potential issue. The second bill I have listed there was House Bill 2171. This was actually the omnibus bill that had some of the tax credit extensions and the requirement for LRO to study some of the results you just saw. But it also included an expanded clarification for the existing exemption, the 307.130 exemption, for nonprofit history and science museums. And this was only a four-year exemption, as Paul mentioned earlier, but it included, I noted it in here, not only because of the recent legislative change, but also because there was a couple of inclusions of specific bright lines. And that was related to retail sales at nonprofit organizations. A lot of times they have a little store or something like that with inside where they sell refreshments and things. And then also theaters was another one that the committee may remember, where there was a bright line for the type of movies that museums may be showing. So in a lot of cases, they're showing educational films, but there's also ones where they're showing more entertaining, or I shouldn't say more entertaining, films that are aimed at entertainment, not necessarily for their educational value. So there's a bright line put in place for those as well.
Sounds really bright.
That's right.
Is it entertainment or is it educational?
Right. The whole political process of this is going to be entertaining.
But those two, I think, were both examples. There's a couple other bills that I could even describe, but they hit on kind of the two points for possible changes.
Right.
So then the exhibit I have here that I've titled Exhibit 2 is really just, it's a timeline of the changes to ORS 307.130 and some of the language that was used to describe the statute during the session was things like archaic, out of date, and part of that stems from the fact that it predates Oregon becoming a state. It's actually from the territorial government. 1854 was as far back as I found it. And for the first 90 or so years, there wasn't a change. Once Oregon became a state and it became part of statute, there was no change. So depending upon how you look at that, you could speak to the way the statute was written or just the fact that there weren't any issues that had come up. Because in a lot of cases, when you see a change made, you can look around that time, right around that same time, and you'll find a court case where an exemption was applied or wasn't applied, and then there's a legislative change made to reflect that. And then also included there, the ones that are highlighted in red, I would just note it's a definitional change. So within the statute, it's contained a definitional tie to the federal definition of nonprofit. That's part of the requirements, is that you are, first you have to be a nonprofit and then you can possibly receive the exemption. So that's the reason why you see so many changes more recently, is it's just part of that Federal Connect update language or legislation. So just to go into briefly into the legal component of the statute 307.130, there's almost two components. There's specifics in the statute related to retail stores dealing primarily in donated inventory, art museums, volunteer fire departments, and there's the larger statute, the broad part of it, that's really about literary, benevolent, charitable, and scientific. One thing I would note here, as I said, the statute has been around for quite a while. It hasn't received a whole lot of changes considering it's been around for over 150 years. But really, the exemption is based upon more of a common law approach or an interpretation of different court rulings. And if you take a look at the DOR rules, it really does reflect that, where they read almost as a summation of the different major court rulings throughout the past 100 years or so. So it really is, there's the statute, because it is broad, it really is, it's common law, so you have to look at what the court decisions have been to find out how to make decisions going forward. And each court decision is really a case-by-case instance of why you gather. There's different steps that can be taken, and I'll go into a little more detail just briefly on what the courts look at. There's no guarantee that because it was ruled in favor of a nonprofit 5 years ago this way, that it will definitely go that way in the future. And that's one of the things that assessors bring up as part of that litigation cost. So the exhibit I have up here, it works through how the courts, the test that the courts have set up to determine whether or not, at a very high level, this is extremely extremely high level, but how to determine whether or not a nonprofit receives the exemption. And it really comes down to, primarily it's going to be two questions that have to be answered, and there's subtests for each of the question. But the first question is the entity a charitable institution? And the second question is the property actually and exclusively occupied or used in the charitable work? So both must be answered yes. And if the first question, are they charitable? If the answer is no, then you don't have to worry about the second question because they don't receive the exemption. But for the first question, if to determine charitability, the courts have set up a three-part test. And the first one is really looking at if the organization, they must have charity as its primary, if not sole, object. So the idea is you can be a nonprofit, but it has to be really the reason you're formed. And a lot of times the courts will look at mission statements and things to see, why does the nonprofit exist? Is it for a charitable purpose, or do they exist for some other reason and they just happen to do some charity on the side? Really, the point of the exemption, the qualification for the exemption, is for aimed at nonprofits that have charity as that primary, if not sole, object. The second part of the test is, or the number two in the test, is the organization must act in performing in a manner that furthers its charitable object. So not only do they have to be nonprofit, be charitable, but they also have to be doing work that is working towards whatever it is, and perhaps say their mission statement, to use that example. So they have to be working towards that. And then the third part of the test is the performance must involve a gift or giving. And that's the final determination on the three-part test. And one of the important things to note in the gift or giving, it's about who's receiving the gift, is how the courts factor it in. So in a lot of cases, nonprofits might receive funding from the government, or they're receiving donations. And so if you think about a nonprofit receiving a grant, in a way, perhaps the government is buying an outcome. So you could say, well, that's not really charity because you're being paid to do the act, but it's whatever the act, whoever is receiving that final outcome from the nonprofit, that's who determines whether it's a gift. So if it's to help low-income individuals do such and such thing, if they're receiving that without cost, or maybe at a reduced cost, that would be the gift to be received. So that's what the courts look at it. There is a separate six-part test that I've listed underneath here that is used primarily for hospitals. It's not just for hospitals, but it's mostly used for nonprofits that have larger revenue streams, because that's a little bit of a separate category, and a lot of times that'll hospitals are probably the best example of that. Within the 307-130, you can also think education may be similar. That's a different statute, but similar as well, where there's larger revenue streams for the nonprofit. And one of the important parts, the six-part test, you don't have to meet all the six components. It is numbers 5 and 6 are the two requirements you must meet, where the other ones are more just used by courts to inform their decision. So number 5 would be the existence of a charitable trust fund for the needy. And then 6 is institution has to be operating without profit or private advantages to founders and officials in charge. So that's the way you can think of that is, if the nonprofit were to cease to exist, the funds that are left over can't go to enrich the individuals at the start of the nonprofit. It would be that's kind of one of the, I guess, the ways to view the test there. So that's step one, is just determine if it's charitable. Second question is the property actually and exclusively occupied and used in the charitable work? So for that, the courts have a two-part test. The first one, property has to be exclusively used by charitable entity in accomplishing its charitable goals, and the second part being property has to be substantially contribute to furthering those goals. And so this two-part test, and you can see this, it's also in the DOR rules, describes something similar. This is what a county assessor would have to look at when they're trying to decide whether a piece of property is exempt or not. And you can see there is still some ambiguity in there, and it's It's what is laid out right now in case law, but of course, courts can, each instance of a nonprofit is different than the previous one, I guess is what I would say. So while this can inform it, it may not be the exact way the test is applied for the next decision. So there's still, even though it sounds like it's, oh, it's very straightforward, you just go through and check the boxes, there's plenty of ambiguity still in there. And then just briefly to go in to what some of the other states do, the big takeaway from what I've seen in the literature I've reviewed here is that Oregon's not alone. And this is first, the exemption is available, or an exemption for charitable entities, nonprofit entities, is available in all 50 states in one way, shape, or form. But Oregon's not alone in struggling on how to apply this. You can look at different states that have, it can depend, some states have it in their constitution, other have it in statute, which sometimes can change the breadth of the exemption. But it is one thing that you can look at different states, and the literature suggests that others have had different success at possibly making changes or even in their interpretation have run into issues. And it's one of the things we'll get to in the final end product of the paper, would to look at some of these different states and some of their successes and where they've run into problems when making changes or just in changes that have come about as things have changed. But that's probably about as much detail as I go into the other states at this point. Yeah. Just to circle back to the beginning, the real idea was to try to brief the committee on some of the work we're doing. Ultimately, this is for the committee members and any potential work group. So if there's anything that I haven't described here that you think would be helpful in the scope, please let us know. We'd be happy to include that.
Thank you. I think we will have a work group that will take a closer look at this. Any questions, Senator Boquist?
Just to clarify in regards to the work group. So, you know, Mr. Chair Kyle, I guess what you're saying here is you're trying to put together what we have now and how do we administratively streamline whatever it is we do, which is what you're doing right now with the assessors, DOR, so on and so forth, which ends up with, for a better word, I guess, a study package along that line. And then step two is the policy point of reviewing the whole list of laundry that we have here of what should the policy be to this, what should be the policy to that, or are there things in the statute that, you know, these nonprofits went away in 1926 and they're no longer around. That's sort of the direction I hear we're going.
Yes, Senator. I think that's the general idea, is to try to really build some foundational knowledge and put that out there so those type of questions can then be informed by this information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll revisit the 1854 territorial rules. Thank you, Kyle.
I wonder if we get nonprofit status for shooting wolves.
All right. It was a long, informative day. I appreciate your patience.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you all. If there's no other business here today, we'll adjourn.
Thank you.